Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to have Anders Osland here again to talk about how things are going with the Russian economy. We can't remember whether this is the third or the fourth time that he's done this, but there's certainly been enough developments to warrant at least four times, and every time Anders comes, he gives us a new insight, which he more than anybody else can give on the Russian economy. He is, of course, the world's leading authority on the, I should say, perhaps post-Soviet economy. He's been actively involved at various times in the actual development of it. From 91 to 93, he was an advisor to the Russian government. And I remember the marvelous conferences. I remember the wonderful conferences which he held when he was director of the Stockholm Center, which did more to bring together Russian and Western economists than I think any other events. And Anders himself has done more of that than any other single person. He's now moved his base to the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, and there he's written his latest definitive book on building capitalism, the transformation of the former Soviet bloc. Of course, every time one refers to a book by Anders, it's the definitive one, but then history moves on and he produces yet another definitive one. So this is the one which we're celebrating in this event tonight, and we're really looking forward to Anders' presentation of its argument. Anders Osland.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Richard, for that very kind introduction. And of course, I should say that Richard and I were working together very closely in Moscow, and that was always a great pleasure, because Richard is always interested in everything that is happening and wants to figure out how it actually works. In the mid-1980s, I was working in Moscow for 3 years as a Swedish diplomat. And if you remember, in March 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev was elected Secretary General of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The Swedish embassy then sent me out to ask what do ordinary Russians think about this. So I posed the most open question. What is the most important event that has occurred this week? And the answer was not what you would have expected. The cucumbers have arrived on the Kolkhoz markets. So the price of cucumbers had fallen from 7 to 3.5 rubles per kilo. The essence of this answer is that there was a sense that everything is stuck in history. Nothing can possibly change. What we have seen since then is a total change. I think that we will look upon this period as one of the great revolutions of all time, fully comparable with the 1917 revolution in Russia, the French Revolution, and the English Revolution. And in a great revolution, you do not really look afterwards for all the details. You look for what is the outcome, what has actually happened in this revolution. What I'm trying to do in this book, Building Capitalism, it is to take a broad picture. And to look upon the big questions and study them thematically for the whole region, what we used to call the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, because these areas had similar starting conditions. And let me share with you 5 theses in this book. There are others, but I want to bring these particular out today. The first time, one is that we are seeing very different models coming out of the transition. It was never obvious what would happen. Another point is that politics was decisive. The economics, by comparison, was pretty easy. And we can say reforms work and drive growth if they're undertaken. Privatization is widely considered the most controversial part of the reforms. But I think that we are now increasingly seeing that it's far more beneficial than people have realized. And finally, something that we are seeing more tentatively is that the Commonwealth of Independent States is now seeing much more radical reforms in some countries after the financial crash of 98. So let me start with three different models. And the first of radical reformers in Central Europe, by which I here mean Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary, and the three Baltic states. What these seven countries have accomplished are, by Freedom House standards, full democracies. They are privatized, according to the EBRD standards, to 70 to 85% of GDP. And they are pretty normal market economies by any standards. These countries have succeeded. You can say that the great heroes in my book are primarily Poland and Estonia, the most radical reformers, closely followed by Hungary. And their problems today are, as Janusz Korczak put it, these are premature social welfare states. The question in that group is essentially, will they be dynamic enough, not if they are stable enough, or what they will become. The second group is the most difficult to establish firmly. You can call them gradual reformers, partial reformers, or late reformers. But reformers they are. And here you have Bulgaria, Romania, and the main former Soviet republics, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. And these countries are, by and large, according to Freedom House standards, semi-democratic. They are privatized, mostly to 60-70% of GDP. And they are market economies, but with a bit more corruption than you would really like to say. So we may call them rent-seeking societies. To me, this has been the most interesting question today. Where are these countries really going? And it's also the main part of it. And the third group is very easy. Non-reformers, in particular Belarus and Turkmenistan, but also Uzbekistan. Full-fledged dictatorships, state-controlled economies, and public ownership, in particular in Belarus and Turkmenistan, to 80%. And from this simple schedule, you get two major points. It was never obvious where these countries were going. Some have made it, and some have totally failed to become democracies and market economies. And another point is that we see a strong correlation between the three features, democracy, privatization, and market economy, to quite another extent than we see in the rest of the world. The point is often made that Russia, for example, needs a general Pinochet. And the obvious response is that dictators have not been effective at all to promote any market economic reforms. So why would you like a dictator? There's no good reason for it. And this is a theme that I delve a lot upon. So why has it become like this? It's very easy. The policy choices have been determined by the goals of the ruling groups. As soon as liberal market reformers have gained a majority in a democracy, a democratic election in a parliament, we have seen that they have got the democracy and market economy they wanted. In most of the countries we have seen, the old elite, the nomenklatura, wanted to make money on transitional market distortions. And they did so very successfully. This is, of course, one of the greatly successful groups in the transition. The big money in Russia and the rest of the Soviet Union was made on buying oil for $1 a ton. At home, at a state-controlled price. And selling it abroad for $100 a ton. Then you can make money. One shipman can make you a multimillionaire. And there were lots of such multimillionaires made in 1991-92. And in order not to suffer too much hardship when you're undertaking such serious business, these same people also managed to get financing from the central banks. In Russia, the credit emission in 92 was about one-third of GDP, Ukraine 40% of GDP, and so on. And these credits were largely gifts by the kind governors of the central banks, because the interest paid was between 10 and 25% per annum, while inflation, for example, in Russia was 2,500%. And that's the reason why Gerashenko, the chairman of the central bank in Russia, became so popular that he was invited back to become chairman of the central bank in Russia again in 98, and just left that post after having been chairman of the central bank for three times, because nobody that I'm aware of, not even George Soros, has given such large gifts to so many good friends as Viktor Gerashenko. And that, of course, made him very popular. And that's very much the part. So the old elite were not against a market economy. They wanted a liberal market economy for themselves and substantial regulations for others. Unfortunately, they got it for some time until rather many people understood the game, so that those gains disappeared. So this was largely 92, 93, when the big money was made, before the privatization. And the third group is easy. Dictators have favored themselves. It's particularly clear when you look up on Turkmenistan and see golden monuments of Turkmenbashi. Then you understand the aim of a state, which is very clearly put. So the point is, the more democracy, the more reform. And you can see it also in this context. Here, you have all the main reformers which have undertaken pretty maximal liberalization according to VBRD liberalization index. And here you have Freedom's House, political and civil liberty. The most liberal up here, and here we have the usual suspects. Belarus, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan at the bottom, both with regard to liberalization and political and civil liberty. So the point in this region during the transition so far has actually been that any check of the elite is beneficial. This is not Torsten Persson, Tabellini's ideas about how political economy functions in the West. It's a quite different world. One point is that parliamentary systems are more reformist than presidential rules. The presidential system essentially exists in the CIS. Its essence is that the presidential administration is a recreation of the old Central Committee. And as the old Central Committee of the Communist Party, it is not regulated by anybody. A parliament is much better to scrutinize what the government actually does. The most surprising point on the political economy of reform is that even sheer government instability benefits reform. You often hear this from the reformers, that give us only one period and we will do it all. Well, look upon Václav Klaus, one of the most intelligent and outstanding reformers. He got two periods. And what did the country get out of that? Stagnation. Whatever happens, you need to have a contested leadership in the transition. There are five countries that have seen a change in government each year. And that has been Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Bulgaria. At least the four first are among the most successful reformers. So government instability actually benefits reform, contrary to what you would intuitively expect. And the point is that you so easily get so much corruption in this transition period that it's better to have as many checks and balances as possible. A similar point is that coalition governments are more effective reformers than one-party governments. The point here being that coalition partners can see pretty well what are the others up to, which is, of course, usually nothing good. So the more scrutinized they are, the less they can make of it. A good example here is Latvia, which is pretty corrupt. It basically has an oligarchic structure. It normally has three or four parties in the government. And even so, the country has been quite a successful reformer, both in terms of reforms undertaken and in terms of growth rate. And by and large, the stronger civil society you have and the freer press you have, the better you do. The obvious case is here, Poland, which has had as messy a political establishment and the civil society you could just ask for. With all of these violent private peasants organizing blockades whenever they get an opportunity, lots of trade unions organizing strikes whenever they can, and a Catholic Church, which is basically against many of the features of a modern society. And all these forces have helped creating a strong civil society so that the country so far has been surprisingly successful. So what do you do if you really get stuck? Quite a few countries have got stuck at times in under-reform traps. You can take Russia, 98. You can take Ukraine for much of the 1990s as good cases. And what we're seeing is that crisis brings change. Most successful reforms have been preceded by severe financial crises, which in turn have led to political crises. And often, the first crisis has not been enough. But you need a second crisis, and by this I mean quite a severe shock, to get it right. I've selected here three countries which I think are particularly a good example. Poland, which we now forget, had a serious crash in 81 under Solidarity, and then again in 89. The first crisis opened up and started certain reforms. After 89, people realized what they had to do, and it got done. In Bulgaria, there was a second crash in 96-97, which was so severe that it led to hyperinflation. And after that, Bulgaria has undertaken impressive reforms. And similarly in Russia, there was a very bad crash in 91, and then again in August 98, quite a frightful crash. But what happened then was that the shock, if we take Russia in 98, broke hit three groups particularly badly. The first group was the oligarchs, which lost not only a lot of money, but also their authority. They didn't have a model to offer that worked. The other group that was discredited was corrupt government, and that was particularly regional governors who showed that their model didn't work. You can say they were the main financiers, in effect, of the oligarchs. And also, perhaps most surprising, communist halfway policies were discredited. And what happened was that people realized you can't go half away. What seemed to us to be a problem of crony capitalism was understood as being a problem of people trying to live on a corrupt state. So I think that the Russians have understood the problem better than we did in the West at the time. And you can say that the main problem here was 16% of GDP going into enterprise subsidies, largely out of regional budgets. So, and this also led to a big budget deficit. Therefore, we've seen a swing in Russia. What was a chronic budget deficit of about 8% of GDP each year became a budget surplus today of 3% of GDP. And the federal government that seemed unable to control the country has now managed to get to almost double its revenues as a share of GDP at the expense of the regions. And the communists realized that they didn't have a very good program, so they changed it to favor market economy at long last before the parliamentary elections in December 99. So what has this meant to output? Because after all, you want to get economic welfare, which is most generally measured in GDP. And then you see this miserable picture. None of the country regions, as I've described them, have actually reached more than the level they had in 89, according to the official statistics. And the radical reformers have done the best, clearly. The outstanding country here, singularly, is Poland. But even they have not got more than the level of 89 by year 2000. And the second line here is not necessarily whom you would expect. It is not the partial reformers, the intermediary reformers, but the non-reformers. So then you wonder, what is this? Does it mean that if you can't reach the top of a hill, it's better not to try to cycle uphill? There are some people who draw that conclusion, most notably Joe Stiglitz has argued that quite strongly, that Uzbekistan, which has not attempted any reforms, has done better than my favorite countries, Russia and Ukraine. And I would not contest that very strongly. And the point I argue most of all is that this universal output collapse is really a statistical mirage. And there are two major problems with it. The first problem is that there has been a huge rise in unmeasured economy after communism. You know, communism was about reaching planned targets. And capitalism is about avoiding taxes. And then, of course, you have two totally different behaviors. And it would be strange if that does not have a massive impact on statistics. In the unreformed countries, there hasn't been much development of new private economic activities that should be measured. In the most reformed countries, it's not so odious to be recorded. So the greatest rise in the unmeasured economy is among the intermediate reformers. And the second point, which is methodologically more difficult, that is that much of production under communism was both worthless and wasteful. to take one general example, the Economic Commission for Europe calculated in the 1980s that one unit of output in the Soviet Union cost three times as large physical inputs as in the West. More concrete example, in 1989, the Soviet Union produced six times more tractors than the United States. And you're only left with a question, why? They didn't get much agricultural output out of that, nor did they export it significantly either. And living in Moscow in the mid-80s, what could you buy in a shop that was really of a Western level? Bread, mineral water, vodka, salt, matryoshkas, woolen shawls, that's about it. Everything else was of the worst quality. So how do you measure that? Another aspect, the Soviet Union in the late 80s probably spent 25% of GDP on the military. Today, that is 3% of GDP. Is this a loss, that 22% of this GDP has gone away? I wouldn't think so. And the investment side, the communist countries invested 30 to 35% of GDP. And then afterwards, we hear everywhere that there was too little investment in the communist countries. What is this? Much of the investment process was sheer wastage. Or it was, for example, inventory investment, which is just to say useless produced goods that couldn't be sold and they were therefore written off, because there was no inventory cycle as in the West. For example, Poland put 7% of GDP into inventory investment every year in the 1980s. And that's where we have the best statistics. So what I come out with is that the decline has been grossly exaggerated. My assessment is that it's been about as bad in the non-reformers as in the intermediate reformers, but probably in the order of 15% of GDP in the first half of the 1990s, and not 50%, as the official statistics say. But this we will never fully agree on, but it's important to understand that this massive decline has not happened. Then we would not have seen that people have been so generally calm. Just a picture to make you remember what a shop in Moscow looked like in 91. Lots of people and no goods. So where does the growth come from? If we look up on the growth when it's happening, it's much less controversial. Here we can see what has happened. And there has been a lot of multi-country regression analysis undertaken by various authors. And by and large, the results are very similar. There's a lot of covariation in it because generally good reformers undertake good reforms. And they do all of them. But the most obvious case standing out everywhere is liberalization of prices and trade, in particular foreign trade, is what has the biggest impact, positive impact on growth. Second point is that inflation needs to be under control. But basically it's enough if it's below 40% a year, it does not much matter how much lower it is. As Rudi Dornbusch uses to say, usually says, that if you have had very high inflation, bring it down to 20% a year and then forget about it. It will go down enough in any case, and because people will be so focused upon it. And what people tend to forget about is that privatization works very well also in all these regression analyses. And what is this? The three major reforms that we were all along pushing for: liberalization, financial stabilization, and privatization. So this means the Washington consensus has worked very well, contrary to what some people tend to say. So let me then move to my more controversial point. Privatization has been much better than its reputation. I've already mentioned that there is a strong correlation with growth. Private enterprises, according to BRD surveys from 1999, receive about 1/4 as much subsidies as state enterprises. And private enterprises are rarely monopolies. Even when monopolies are privatized, which has happened in several countries in telecommunications, private companies are very bad at defending monopolies, while state companies are very good at it. And something quite important: privatization and liberalization go together. Here we have all the strong reformers, and here we have Belarus, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. And therefore it doesn't much matter what kind of structural reform index we use, how much privatization there is, and how much liberalization. They are very closely correlated. And the same is true of privatization and democracy. And I would argue, without the mass privatization in Russia, it's quite possible that Russia would have ended up as Belarus. The real alternative to Russia was Belarus. And the big problem with Belarus was that it did not undertake early reforms, and the dictatorship only emerged as a result of the elections in July 94 in Belarus. And then there were no forces that could stand up. You need private property to stand up against dictatorship. I should argue here, I often get comments on Russia that it's an outlier here. I would rather put Russia here. The problem is that the leadership of Freedom House, whom I'm relying upon for political and civil liberties, and I generally think that they do a good job, tend to be Ukrainians. So obviously Ukraine has to be better here than Russia, while I would argue that Ukraine is somewhat less democratic than Russia, but this is a very contentious issue. Let me move on to the role of the West, which of course has been very controversial. And I have two major points to make here. The first is that Western aid has been tiny. In total, transition countries' debt service of old communist loans have been greater than Western grants and official loans. According to the IMF accounts, there was actually a net outflow from the transition countries from 93 to 96 of $22 billion. This is primarily Russia serving the old Soviet debt, and Poland as well. Also Hungary and Bulgaria. And in particular, I've taken pleasure in calculating the U.S. peace dividend and comparing that with U.S. support for economic reforms in Russia. and the peace dividend I've calculated as the reduction in US defense budget as a share of GDP compared with 82 to 89 when defense comprised 6% of GDP. By 2000, it was down to 3% of GDP. That is $300 billion. And you know, the US budget deficit used to be about 3% of GDP, the one that President Clinton so successfully abolished. But in effect, this abolition of the US budget deficit was undertaken by two other presidents, Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, who removed the Soviet threat to the US so that the US could cut over time its defense expenditures by 3% of GDP. In total, I get the US peace dividend from the 1990s to $1.4 trillion. And you can compare this with $2.6 billion that the US committed in USAID budget for Russia. It's all in current US dollars. So the US peace dividend was about 500 times bigger than US support for economic reform. And you can hardly do much better than that, can you? On the other hand, my other big point about Western aid to the region is that it has been surprisingly effective. There were three big aims of this aid. It was to build market economies, financial stabilization, and privatization. And the results have been that market economies have been created in all but three countries, Belarus, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Inflation is under control in all countries apart from Belarus. This is the achievement essentially of the IMF. It has cost substantial amounts of money in loans, no grant money at all here. And then 60% of GDP in the region as a whole has been privatized. The world has never seen a privatization on this scale at all. I think in history that we will remember this as one of the great and extraordinary achievements that changed this region forever. And the USAID, the World Bank, and the EBRD provided very substantial technical assistance in these regards. And I think they should be honored for that. Finally, a few words about the current situation that people tend to forget because things are looking too good. And you know, when things are looking good, they're becoming boring. It's much more interesting when we see a serious crisis. And after the Russian financial crash, which in one way or the other seriously affected much of the former Soviet Union, we see new radical reforms in many CIS countries. Of course, Russia is the most prominent here, but it involves much of the region. The first observation is that the 12 CIS countries have had an average growth of 6% for a year for the last 3 years. When you see such numbers, you look up and you say, something has happened here. And it can't only be oil prices and devaluation, which is the standard argument. And then you compare it with the 10 EU accession countries in Central and Eastern Europe, and you realize they have only had 3% growth a year on average for the last 3 years. So what has happened? Well, first of all, they have got budgets close to balance. It's also true of Central and Eastern Europe, but that involves very much getting hard budget constraints as well. And something that the CIS countries have done that the Central and East European countries have not done is that they have lowered public expenditure substantially. Here you have the overall picture. Central and Eastern Europe have only got from 44% of GDP in 93 to 41% in year 2000, a minor decline. The CIS average, by contrast, has gone from 45% of GDP in public expenditure in 93 to 28% of GDP in 2000, and it's continuing to decline. A reason behind this, why it has been possible, is partly that it has been necessary in these countries, while these countries have collected enough taxes. Another reason has been that much of the public expenditure here is social transfer in Central and Eastern Europe. Here, the big cuts have hit two items, and that has been enterprise subsidies that you don't want to have in any case, and the other has been public investments, which tend to be a major source of corruption. And you don't want to have large sources of corruption in rather corrupt countries. So then you want to have relatively less of public investment. And what we are also seeing is radical tax reforms. And this is not only the CIS countries, but also in the Baltic countries, but hardly at all in Central Europe. So we are seeing ever lower flat income taxes. Estonia pioneered with 26%. Latvia went for 25% to be one better on Estonia. And Georgia went to 20%. And last year, Russia introduced 13% flat income tax. The immediate effect was a substantial increase in real tax revenues because of a flat income tax. People want to be honest if it doesn't cost too much. And the question is, where is the borderline? In Russia, 13% seem to be a relevant level. And we're also seeing ever lower profit taxes. Estonia, as often has been the most radical here, abolishing them altogether in 2000. You know, profit taxes are taxes on enterprise, honesty, and initiative. And the Estonians don't think that these are things that should be taxed. They should rather be favored. And other countries have cut them substantially. 20%, for example, in Georgia and in Kyrgyzstan, 24% in Russia. Payroll taxes are falling in the CIS. The lowest is now Kazakhstan, which has also undertaken a Chilean pension reform, totally privatizing the new pension system. Several other countries have gone down to 33% in total payroll taxes, while in East Central Europe, the payroll taxes tend to be around 50%. So this is a big difference. Romania has a payroll tax of 57%. You don't want to work hard, too hard if you have 57% payroll tax. And indeed, I think this is a major reason why we are seeing less economic activity in Central Europe. And something that is now pushing small enterprises is low lump sum taxes for single entrepreneurs, and particularly in Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan. And when you see all this together, and there's a lot more to be added, then you would expect more economic growth to follow. To this you should add, if you're a laggard and you have a catching up effect that also benefits you. For the future, and this is not from the book, I think that we will look to trade as a major issue, what we now should be more focused on. And I'll just make two observations here. reforms and exports to the EU have gone together in Central and Eastern Europe, the 10 EU accession countries. The EU has been very liberal towards those countries, so they've been able to expand their exports as a share of total exports to the EU from 50% in 89 to 67% in 2000. But this is not true of the CIS. Their share of exports going to the EU is as small today as it was a decade ago, barely one third. Here you have the scheme. And you can see this is structural reform index for the EU accession countries, and here for the CIS countries. The CIS countries are lagging behind, but we are moving in parallel with Central and Eastern Europe. And here you have Central and East European exports to the EU as share of their total exports. And these three curves are in parallel. By contrast, you have a totally different curve here, which doesn't move up at all. That's CIS export to the European Union. It used to be said that the problem here is that they have not reformed enough themselves. I think that was true for some time. But now I think that case cannot quite be made. And I think that this is one of the big issues of integrating the CIS countries more into the world economy, and of course, most of all, to the European Union, because it's just beside. And I think this is a big issue for the future. So what can we say about the situation as a whole? I would argue this is a substantial change of economic systems. We have reached a qualitatively totally different state. And we are now seeing a new growth rising in a large part of the region. So therefore, I'm quite happy with Cambridge University Press having chosen this front page of my book. You see, there is dawn at the Kremlin, and we are just waiting for the full sunshine. Thank you.
What a wonderful, masterly survey, and enough to provoke many comments, questions. Who wants to start?
Hello, Professor Asland. You said that democracy works, parliamentary systems were better than presidential systems. Was the West wrong to support Boris Yeltsin against the Russian Parliament in 1993?
No, I'm strongly defending that point. The point is that Russian Parliament that was elected on the 4th of March 1990 was elected under a system that could not be called democratic by any stretch of imagination. These were totally haphazard figures. In the big cities, there was a civil organization, so you saw the major communists being ousted. In a lot of places, you saw the top communists being ousted, and instead, haphazard communists were elected instead. 87% of the deputies who were elected were Communist Party members. It's true that many of these were reformers, but the reform share was never more than about one third, and this had no correlation to the public opinion in the country. Much of the elections in the countryside, we have all reason to believe, was never the democratic, even in a technical sense. You were not allowed to provide information. You were not allowed to have parties in the standing, and you were not allowed to have campaign financing. So this was a very undemocratic election, while it was a great improvement. By contrast, Boris Yeltsin was elected on the 12th of June 91 against the establishment with, was it 57 or 58% of the vote in a high turnout. So you had a president who represented democracy and had legitimacy, while the parliament had was neither democratically elected nor had a legitimacy, and therefore the West was right to stand by the president. I personally has argued all along that Yeltsin should have dissolved the parliament much earlier. My ideal scenario would have been that he had would ask the parliament in November 91 for its dissolution, when it would probably have been accepted, and held elections in the second quarter of 92. The Soviet constitution from 1978 was fundamentally flawed in the same way as the Polish constitution in the 18th century was flawed, and the Swedish constitution of 1751, giving the parliament sovereignty. And you need some kind of balance of power. It was not there. So therefore, I think that it was a very good thing and the democratic thing to support Yeltsin.
Can I just come back? No, I think we need to move on. It's not a sense.
No, please respond. Okay.
It just appears to me that the Russian political system as it's set up is a mechanism for keeping the Communist Party out of power. Whereas, you know, I mean, the Communist Party, I mean, I lived in Russia also, it is the only serious political party. There aren't any others with grassroots support. Wouldn't it be better to let them learn? I mean, a lot of the other Communist parties in Eastern Europe, as you spoke about, have returned to government, have reformed, become social democrats and so on. It seems that the Communist Party in Russia has never been allowed that learning experience because of this awful presidential system that excludes them. I mean, that was really my point. I mean, and, you know, the coup itself was a very confused affair and so forth. But, okay, fair enough.
Okay, yes. Julia.
You seem to have suggested that Russia benefited...
Closer.
Can you put it on?
Closer, simply.
You seem to have suggested that Russia benefited a lot from the 98 crisis, which discredited rent seekers and communist reforms and allowed for a certain policy shift. However, I'm afraid if you ask many Russians, they will tell you that what was indeed discredited were Western liberal policies during the crisis. And subsequent growth of Russia after 98 could be simply attributed to ruble devaluation and benign oil prices. So what gives you a rise for optimism regarding the shift in the policy stance of Russian politicians?
You have that view also, but you see the view that is being substantiated by policies is the argument I make. This oil prices, it doesn't hold, or devaluation. Why has Ukraine seen a growth in the last 2 years, 6% and 9% respectively? It suffered from the higher oil prices, and we are seeing the growth throughout the region. You would then say, but Ukraine has benefited from Russia's growth. Well, Ukraine didn't increase its, Russia did not increase its imports from the other CIS countries last year, so that doesn't quite hold either. We happen to believe in a certain economic model that it has effects. And then this economic model is being implemented and it has positive effects. It's difficult to make a regression analysis on only one or a couple of years, but it all hangs very well together. And we had an argument before, which were the fundamental problems in Russia. You can see them all over. big budget deficit, big enterprise subsidies, barter, a hopeless arbitrary tax system. All these four problems have been resolved. It would be very strange if that wouldn't have a positive effect. And we are seeing the same positive effects in most of the other countries that are now seeing a substantial growth. By contrast, all these people who say that the oil price and devaluation is the important thing undertook a substantial number of forecasts in January 2000. The consensus forecast of about 20 forecasters for Russia then was a growth that year of 1.5%. In fact, Russia happened to have a growth of 9.0%. So there was something wrong in their analysis. And these people find it rather difficult to face up to their forecasts being totally wrong from the actual outcome. I think that that is very much the issue. But what you say is indeed a point that is frequently made. I strongly contest it.
You mentioned that right now trade is an important problem for Russia, and particularly trade with the EU. But I would ask, how would you describe Russia's relationship with the WTO, particularly as it attempts the accession process?
I'm not blaming the EU particularly here. As my main point to say is that it seems to me that trade is the big issue that we have not discussed enough. Much of the discussion has been focused on what a country should do to itself. And we have had very little discussion or indeed study of how countries interact with one another. And now we are seeing at the next stage that issues of protectionism and trade barriers are becoming a big a problem. Indeed, I think that joining the WTO is the first major step that all these countries should undertake in order to sort out their trade problems. So Russia has now, for the last 2 years or so, made accession to the WTO a priority. Admittedly, Russia applied for membership in the fall of 1993. We were very much pushing for that at the time. But it became an issue of the old foreign trade bureaucrats in Russia. And they just calmed the politicians, saying that next year or the year after next, we will become members of the WTO. So it was in the Russian establishment, and generally through much of the CIS, perceived as a natural bureaucratic development, not something that you really have to engage in and that you should become politics. And then this never happened, and nobody particularly paid attention to it until early 2000, when fortunately this hopeless Ministry of External Economic Relations was abolished. So the only way of putting the WTO issue on the agenda in Russia was by abolishing this ministry. The government is very much pushing for it now, and President Putin. Their hope is that they can get in by the fall of next year. Normally, WTO processes take much longer. So I just hope that it will happen as soon as possible, since this is a matter of multiple bilateral negotiations. It's extremely difficult to say how it will develop, since there are so many issues involved.
I'd like to congratulate you on a very masterful presentation.
Let me just tell the audience, I think we'll have two more questions and one from me.
Could perhaps if you could just wait until we finished, let's wrap it up without people going out between now and then.
Mm. It's an excellent presentation, but as you know, we have some differences long-standing, but which we won't get into now. But I think I'd like to just challenge you on one point that you've made, not on the Washington consensus. That will take too long. But the fact that notwithstanding the problems with official statistics, I think you're minimizing the tremendous costs of a lost, not a decade, I think a lost generation. If you want to disregard economic statistics and financial statistics, that's fine. But let's then not be selective on what you choose. I don't think goods in Moscow are necessarily the best indicator. I think they're very real statistics about poverty, malnutrition amongst children in almost all the CIS countries. And I think those are very serious, and you cannot say that those economic costs can be disregarded.
I'm not saying that, but who thought this would be easy? There would be costs involved in a collapse. It's also a question, when did the costs involve concern? Of course, communism was very much about introducing as many poison pills as possible in order to enhance the cost of doing away with communism. What was nationalization about? Stopping the return of capitalists forever. Of course it would cost something before you get that right. And all these economic distortions, the more distorted the prices, the bigger the poison pill. We're seeing it in all studies, a big difference is either between the former Soviet Union or between the CIS and Central Europe. And one measurement here is the year of communism. Another is the degree of distortion of the prices. A third, the degree of distortion of industrial structure. Of course, real social costs. And you have to expect that will happen. If you look upon health statistics for countries like Poland and the Czech Republic, their infant mortality has fallen by half in a decade. The number of university students in Poland has tripled in a decade. I discuss in my book the standard issues about life expectancy and infant mortality. Infant mortality has fallen throughout most of this region by about 30% or so in the after 1995. There's not been a collapse in health budgets, pensions, or education. If I remember rightly now, health budgets have increased virtually in most, almost all countries, apart from the war-ridden countries, which I don't discuss because much because I think that's really another issue. I don't discuss war as a major aspect. So, yes, there have been real social costs, but they've largely been exaggerated. I discuss income inequality, which has increased. But what we are seeing is that Central Europe has seen an increase in income inequality to West European levels. And the CIS has seen an increase to American levels. Well, what we are seeing in the CIS is a more American economic system. So there's nothing very surprising about this. It's not a Latin American level of income inequality. In general, we're seeing the more income inequality statistics are being elaborated, the better they get. But indeed, you have some basket cases. And Tajikistan, it's very much a question of civil war. Georgia, civil war. Armenia has suffered very badly from blockades and war. Moldova, from not having control over Transnistria and from having been blocked from EU markets. If you would pick one single really suffering country from EU protectionism, it's Moldova. It has something like 20% of its exports to the European Union, all of it's located just beside it. Why? Because virtually everything Moldova can export is agricultural goods. And the European Union, by and large, doesn't accept such imports. And then you have Kyrgyzstan, which simply has very few resources. So these are the five most poorest countries in the former Soviet Union. Probably should have Turkmenistan, which is suffering from a frightful dictatorship, and Uzbekistan, the same thing. So these are the seven poorest countries, and you can't argue that, which you don't, that this is a problem of too much reform. It's a problem of a disruption, and when the reforms have not been carried out fully. And of course, the Central Asian countries did get substantial resource flow, probably in the order of 10-20% of GDP from Moscow before. And if you lose those resource flows, of course you get poorer. And much of this went into social expenditure before.
It appears to me that you are significantly underestimating the impact of oil, in particular when oil products, gas, and oil itself accounts for some 50% of about $100 billion or so exports. I mean, to look at current account, for example, balance, in 1999, it was nearly balanced. In 2000, you had a surplus of about 18% of GDP, coming down to roughly about 11% of GDP last year. Also, I think if you look at the relationship between oil prices and fiscal revenues, it's fairly strong. If you look at which components of budget revenues have actually increased, you will see that it is the revenues from trade tariffs. You will see that it's revenue from corporate earnings that doubled as a percent of GDP from 1999 to 2001. And I think that's primarily driven, again, by oil prices. Again, if you look at the relationship between reserve accumulation and oil prices, if you look at the relationship, again, between oil prices and relatively high wage growth and reliquidation of the economy, I think it's pretty clear. So it's really very difficult to underestimate that component.
I'm not saying that this is irrelevant. I'm saying this doesn't explain the growth of 12 countries. And Russia is here. It's had a 6.5% growth in the course of the last 3 years. I'm pointing out that we are seeing a similar trend in a lot of countries. And then to explain it, why the peculiar experiences of essentially three countries, does not Russia, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan, does not explain the whole story. Of course, it's part of the story. I'm not denying that. Much of the current account surplus is rightly held abroad and is being used to pay off the foreign debt and is thereby not directly impacting the GDP, but it is improving the international standing of Russia. So these are part of issues. Russia has had a budget surplus, indeed, of 3% of the GDP the last 2 years. And that's a sensible policy. Of course, oil prices go up and down. But if you noticed, I discussed rather substantial reforms. And it would be strange if those that have been carried out in many different countries would not have a substantial impact.
I'd like to say that I think this has been an extraordinary evening, an absolutely wonderful lecture, and some really tough questions, which I think Anders has given good answers to. I personally agree with most of what Anders is saying, but it's clear that whatever one thinks about the arguments, they're very, very important ones. Anders has obviously, in his book, deployed a mass of information bearing on all of these central issues, and it's clear that this book is going to be one of the central books on this subject from which the whole debate will evolve. So I'd like to congratulate Anders and thank him very much for coming and presenting it to us. Thank you.